was making me squirm, and I wasn't all that crazy about his tone. Look, maybe I haven't really dealt with that. I just don't want to be a victim anymore. I'm sick of it. Henry cradled the bowl in his arms, whisking the eggs with a practiced ease. When I do that, the eggs always slop out the side. He said, When were you ever a victim? You don't have to justify yourself to me. You did what you did. Just don't try to turn it into a philosophical statement because it doesn't ring true. It's not as if you made a rational decision after months contemplating the facts. You killed somebody in the heat of the moment. It's not a platform for a political campaign, and it's not a turning point in your intellectual life. I smiled at him tentatively. I'm still a good person, aren't I? I didn't like the wistful tone. I meant to show him I was a grown-up, coping with the truth. Until the words came out of my mouth, I hadn't even known I felt so unsure. He didn't smile back. His eyes rested on my face for a moment, and then dropped back to the eggs. What happened to you doesn't change that, Kinsey. But you have to keep it straight. Blow somebody's brains out, and you don't brush that off. And you don't try to turn it into an intellectual stance. No, you don't, I said uneasily. I had a quick flash of the face that peered into the garbage bin just before I fired. By some remarkable distortion, I could have sworn I saw how the first bullet stretched the flesh like elastic before smashing through. I shook the image away and hopped down. I have to run, I said, feeling anxious. I left the kitchen without glancing back, but I know what the look was on Henry's face. Caution and sorrow and pain. Once outside, I had to put it out of my mind again. Back the subject went into its own little box. I did a quick stretch, concentrating on my hamstrings. I don't run fast enough or far enough to justify much of a warm-up. Other joggers I know would argue with that, citing injuries that result from insufficient stretching before a run. But I find exercise loathsome enough without adding contortions up front. For a time I tried it, dutifully lying on my back in the grass, with one leg straight out and the other cocked sideways toward my waist, as though broken at the hip. I could never get up afterward unless I flopped about like a bug, and I finally decided it was worth a possible groin muscle pull to avoid the indignity. I've never been injured running anyway. I've never thrilled to it either. I'm still waiting for the rumored euphoria that apparently infuses everyone but me. I headed over to the boulevard at a brisk walk, keeping my mind blank. I generally do 3 miles, jogging along the bicycle path that borders the beach. The walkway is stenciled with odd cartoons at intervals, and I watch for those, counting off the quarter miles. The tracks of some improbable bird, the mark of a single fat tire that crosses the concrete and disappears into the sand. There are usually tramps on the beach, some who camp there permanently, others in transit, their sleeping bags arranged under the palm trees, like large green larvae, or the skins shed by some night-stirring beast. That afternoon the air seemed heavy and chill, the ocean sluggish. The cloud cover was beginning to break up, but the visible sky was a pale, washed-out blue, and there was no real sign of sun. Out on the water, a speedboat ran a course parallel to the beach, and the path of the wake was like a spinning ribbon of silver winding along behind. On the landward side, the mountains were dark green. At this distance, the low-growing vegetation looked like soft suede, with rock face showing through along the ridges as though the nap had worn away from hard use. I did the turnaround at East Beach and ran the mile and a half back, then walked the block to my apartment as a cool-down. I'm big on cool-downs. I showered and dressed again, and then hopped in my car and headed up to Pam Sharkey's office on Chapel. Pam was the insurance agent who'd written up the policies for Leonard Grice, and I wanted to probe that issue before I set it aside. I trust Vera, but I don't like taking people's word for things. Maybe Grice had taken out a massive policy from some other company. How did I know? The Valdez building is located at the corner of Chapel and Feria, a Spanish word meaning fair. I only know that because I looked it up. I've been thinking I should take a Spanish class one of these days, but I haven't gotten around to it yet. I can say taco and gracias, but I'm real short on verbs. The Valdez is typical of the architecture in this town. Two stories of white stucco with a red tile roof, big arches, windows faced with wrought iron gratings. There are azure blue awnings, and the landscaping consists of small plots of perfect grass. Palm trees grace the courtyard, and there's a fountain capped by a small, naked boy doing something wicked with a fish. Pam Sharkey's office is on the first floor and sports the same network of cubicles I'd seen at California Fidelity. Nothing architecturally innovative for the insurance game these days. It must be like doing business in a series of playpens. The company she works for, Lambeth & Creek, is an independent agency that writes policies for a number of companies, CFI being one. I'd only dealt with Pam once when I was bird-dogging an errant husband. His wife, my client, was in the process of divorcing him and was hoping for evidence of his philandering as a negotiating tool when it came down to the settlement. Pam had taken offense, not because I'd uncovered her affair with the man, but because I'd turned up two other women involved with him at the same time. None of this was ever brought up in court, of course, but her name was prominent in my report. She had never forgiven me for knowing too much. Santa Teresa is a small town, and our paths cross now and then. We're polite to one another, but the civilities are undercut with spite on her part, and sly amusement on mine. Pam is petite, a bristly little chihuahua of a human being. She's the only woman I ever met who claims to be 10 years older than she actually is, so that everyone will tell her how young she looks. On that basis, she swears she's 38. Her face is small, her skin dusky, and she applies pancake makeup in varying shades in a vain attempt to add planes to her cheeks. I got news for her. There's no way to disguise the bags under your eyes by the skillful use of cover. From most angles, anybody with a brain can see the bag sitting right there, only looking phantom white instead of gray. Who's fooled by this? Why not go for the dark circles and at least look exotic and worldly wise? Anna Magnani, Jean Moreau, Simone Signoret, perhaps. Pam had also taken lately to a permanent wave, so her pale brown hair looked frizzy and unkempt, a style apparently billed as the bedroom look. This afternoon she was done up in a little hunting outfit. A hacking jacket, brown knickers, pink hose, and low heels with buckles. The only hunting she did was in singles bars, bagging one-night stands as though the season were nearly over and her license about to expire. Well, wait a minute here. I can see I've been unfair about this. I don't like Pam any more than she likes me. Every time I see her, it makes me feel petty and mean. Not my favorite way to experience myself. Maybe she avoids me for the same reason. Her cubicle is near the front. A status symbol, I think. She caught sight of me and busied herself with papers and files. By the time I'd made my way over to her desk, she was on the phone. She must have been talking to a man because her manner was flirtatious. She touched herself everywhere as she talked, rolling a lock of hair around her finger, checking an earring, stroking the lapel of her jacket. She wore a series of gold necklaces, and those got to work out, too. Sometimes she'd rub her chin with a loop of gold chain, uttering a carefree, trilling laugh she must have practiced late at night. She glanced at me, feigning surprise, holding up a palm to indicate that I'd have to wait. She turned away from me in her swivel chair, completing the telephone exchange with a murmured intimacy of some sort. On top of a stack of files on her desk, I could see a copy of Cosmo, offering articles on the G-spot, cosmetic breast surgery, and social rape. Pam hung up at long last and swiveled back, all the animation leaving her face. No point in wasting the whole show on me. Something I can help you with, Kinsey? I understand you wrote a couple of policies for Leonard and Marty Grice. That's right. I smiled slightly. Could you tell me the status of the paperwork at this point? Pam broke eye contact, going through another quick digital survey. Earring, hair, lapel. She took up a loop of gold chain, running her index finger back and forth on it, until I worried she'd saw right through the skin. She wanted to tell me Leonard Grice was none of my business, but she knew I did occasional work for California Fidelity. What's the problem? No problem, I said. Vera Lipton's wondering about the claim on the fire loss, and I need to know if there were any other policies in effect. Now, wait a minute. Leonard Grice is a very dear man, and he's been through a terrible 6 months. If California Fidelity intends to make trouble, Vera better deal directly with me. Who said anything about trouble? Vera can't even process the claim until the proof of loss is in. That goes without saying, Kinsey, she said. I still don't see what this has to do with you. I could feel my smile begin to set like a pan of fudge. I leaned forward, left hand flat on the desk, right hand resting on my hip. I thought it was time to clarify our relationship. Not that it's any of your business, Pam, but I'm in the middle of a big investigation adjunctive to this. You don't have to cooperate, but I'm just going to turn around and present a court order to the supervisor here, and somebody's going to come down on you like a ton of bricks for all the trouble it'll cause. Now, is that how you want to proceed on this, or what? Under the pancake makeup, she began to show signs of sunburn. I hope you don't think you can intimidate me, she said. Absolutely not. I shut my mouth then and let her assimilate the threat. I thought it sounded pretty good. She took up a stack of papers and wrapped them on the desk, aligning the edges. Leonard Grice was insured through California Fidelity Life and California Fidelity Casualty Insurance. He collected $2,500 for the life insurance, and he'll get $25,000 for the structural damage to the house. The contents were uninsured. Why only $25,000 for the house? I thought that place was worth over $100,000. He won't have enough money to do the repairs, will he? When he bought the place in 1962, it was worth $25,000, and that's what he insured it for. He never increased the coverage, and he hasn't taken out any other policies. Personally, I don't see how he can do anything with the house. It's a complete loss, which I think is what's broken him. Now that she'd told me, I felt guilty for all the macho bullshit I'd laid on her. Thanks. That's a big help, I said. By the way, Vera wanted me to ask if you'd be interested in meeting an unattached aerospace engineer with Bucks. A wonderful look of uncertainty crossed her face. Suspicion, sexual hunger, greed. Was I offering her a cookie or a flat brown turd on a plate? I knew what was going through her head. In Santa Teresa, a single man is on the market maybe 10 days before someone snaps him up. She shot me a worried look. What's wrong with him? Why didn't you take him first? I just came off a relationship, I said. I'm in retreat. Which was true.
Maybe I'll give Vera a buzz, she said faintly.
Great. Thanks again for the information, I said, and I gave her a little wave as I moved away from her desk. With my luck, she'd fall in love with the guy and want me to be a bridesmaid. Then I'd be stuck with one of those dumb dresses with a hunk of flounce on the hip. When I glanced back at her, she seemed to have shrunk, and I felt a twinge. She wasn't so bad. Chapter 11. I ate dinner that night at Rosie's, a little place half a block down from my apartment. It's a cross between a neighborhood bar and an old-fashioned beanery, sandwiched between a laundromat on the corner and an appliance repair shop that a man named McPherson operates out of his house. All three of these businesses have been in operation for over 25 years and are now, in theory, illegal, representing zoning violations of a profound and offensive sort, at least to people who live somewhere else. Every other year, some overzealous citizen gets a bug up his butt and goes before the city council denouncing the outrage of this breach of residential integrity. In the off years, I think money changes hands. Rosie herself is probably 65, Hungarian, short and top-heavy, a creature of moo-moos and hennaed hair growing low on her forehead. She wears lipstick in a burnt orange shade that usually exceeds the actual shape of her mouth, giving the impression that she once had a much larger set of lips. She uses a brown eyebrow pencil lavishly, making her eyes look stern and reproachful. The tip of her nose comes close to meeting her upper lip. I sat down in my usual booth near the back. There was a mimeographed menu sheet clipped into a clear plastic cover stuck between the ketchup bottle and the napkin box. The selections were typed in pale purple, like those notices they used to send home with us when we were in grade school. Most of the items were written in Hungarian. Words with lots of accent marks and Z's and double dots, suggesting that the dishes would be fierce and emphatic. Rosie marched over, pad and pencil poised, her manner withdrawn. She was feeling offended about something, but I wasn't sure yet what I'd done. She snatched the menu out of my hand and put it back, writing out the order without consulting me. "If you don't like the way the place is run, you go somewhere else." She finished writing and squinted at the pad, checking the results. She wouldn't quite meet my eyes.
"You didn't come in for a week, so I figured you was mad at me," she said. "I bet you've been eating junk, right? Don't answer that. I don't want to hear. You don't owe me an apology. You're just lucky I give you something decent. Here's what you're gonna get."
She consulted the pad again with a critical eye, reading the order to me then with interest, as though it were news to her too.
"Green pepper salad. Fantastic. The best. I made it myself, so I know it's done right. Olive oil, vinegar, little pinch of sugar. Forget the bread, I'm out. Henry didn't bring fresh today, so what do I know? He could be mad at me too. How do I know what I did? Nobody tells me these things. Then I give you sour oxtail stew."
She crossed that off.
"Too much grease. Is no good for you. Instead, I give you tejfele sult ponti. Some nice pike I bake in cream. And if you clean your plate, I could give you deep-fried cherries, if I think you deserve it, which you don't. The wine I'm gonna bring with the flatware. Is Austrian, but okay."
She marched away then, her back straight, her hair the color of dried tangerine peels. Her rudeness sometimes has an eccentric charm to it, but it's just as often simply irritating, something you have to endure if you want to eat Rosie's meals. Some nights I can't tolerate verbal abuse at the end of the day, preferring instead the impersonal mechanics of a drive-in restaurant, or the peace and quiet of a peanut butter and dill pickle sandwich at home. That night Rosie's was deserted, looking drab and not quite clean. The walls are paneled in construction-grade plywood sheets, stained dark, with a matte finish of cooking fumes and cigarette smoke. The lighting is wrong, too pale, too generalized, so that the few patrons who do wander in look sallow and unwell. A television set on the bar usually flashes colored images with no sound, and a marlin arched above it looks like it's fashioned of plaster of Paris and dusted with soot. I'm embarrassed to say how much I like the place. It will never be a tourist attraction. It will never be a singles bar. No one will ever discover it or award it even half a star. It will always smell like spilled beer, paprika, and hot grease. It's a place where I can eat by myself and not even have to take a book along in order to avoid unwelcome company. A man would have to worry about any woman he could pick up in a dive like this. The front door opened, and the old crone who lives across the street came in, followed by Jonah Robb, whom I'd talked to that morning in Missing Persons. I almost didn't recognize him at first in his civilian clothes. He wore jeans, a gray tweed jacket, and brown desert boots. His shirt looked new, the package folds still evident, the collar tightly starched and stiff. He carried himself like a man with a shoulder holster tucked up under his left arm. He had apparently come in to look for me, because he headed straight for my table and sat down. I said, "Hello, have a seat."
"I heard you hung out in here," he said.
He glanced around and his brows gave a little lift, as though the rumor were true but hard to believe.
"Does the health department know about this place?"
I laughed. Rosie, coming out of the kitchen, caught sight of Jonah and stopped dead in her tracks, retreating as though she'd been yanked backward by a rope. He looked over his shoulder to see if he'd missed something.
"What's the matter? Could she tell I was a cop? Has she got a problem with that?"
"She's checking her makeup. There's a mirror just inside the kitchen door," I said. Rosie appeared again, simpering coquettishly as she brought my silverware and plunked it down on the table, tightly bound in a paper napkin.
"You never said you was entertaining," she murmured. "Does your friend intend to have a little bite to eat? Some liquid refreshment, perhaps? Beer, wine, a mixed drink?"
"Beer sounds good," he said. "What do you have on tap?"
Rosie folded her hands and regarded me with interest. She never deals directly with a stranger, so we were forced to go through this little playlet in which I interpreted as though suddenly employed by the UN.
"You still have Mick on tap?" I asked.
"Of course. Why would I have anything else?"
I looked at Jonah, and he nodded assent.
"I think we'll have a Mick, then."
"Are you eating? The food's great."
"Fine with me," he said. "What do you recommend?"
"Why don't you just double the order, Rosie? Could you do that for us?"
"Of course."
She glanced at him with sly approval.
"I had no idea," she said.
I could feel her mentally nudge me with one elbow. I knew what her appraisal consisted of. She favored weight in men. She favored dark hair and easygoing attitudes. She moved away from the table then, artfully leaving us alone. She isn't nearly as gracious when I come in with women friends.
"What brings you here?" I said.
"Idleness, curiosity.
I did a background check on you to save us talking about all the stupid stuff."
"So we could get right down to what?" I asked.
"You think I'm on the make or something?"
"Sure," I said. "New shirt, no wedding ring? I bet your wife left you week before last and you shaved less than an hour ago. The cologne isn't even dry on the side of your neck." He laughed. He had a harmless face and good teeth. He leaned forward on his elbows.
"Here's how it went," he said. "I met her when I was 13, and I was with her from that time to this. I think she grew up and I never could. At least, not with her. I don't know what to do with myself. Actually, she's been gone for a year. It just feels like a week. You're the first woman I've looked at since she went off."
"Where'd she go?"
"Idaho. She took the kids. Two," he said, as though he knew I'd ask that next. "One girl 10, another one 8. Courtney and Ashley. I'd have named them something else. Sarah and Diane, Patty and Jill, something like that. I don't even understand girls. I don't even know what they think about. I really love my kids, but from the day they were born, it was like they were in this exclusive little club with my wife. I couldn't seem to get a membership, no matter what I did."
"What was your wife's name?"
"Camilla." "Shit." She ripped my heart out by the roots. "I put on 30 pounds this year."
"Time to take it off," I said.
"Time to do a lot of things."
Rosie came back to the table with a beer for him and a glass of white table wine for me. "Do I know this story or what? Men just out of marriages are a mess, and I was a mess myself. I already knew all the pain, uncertainty, and mismanaged emotions." Even Rosie sensed it wasn't going to fly. She looked at me like she couldn't figure out how I'd blown it so fast. When she left, I got back to the subject at hand. "I'm not doing all that well myself," I said.
"So I heard. I thought we could help each other out."
"That's not how it works."
"You want to go up to the pistol range and shoot sometime?"
I laughed. I couldn't help myself. He was all over the place. "Sure, we could do that. What kind of gun do you have?"
"Colt Python with a 6-inch barrel. It'll take a .38 or a .357 Magnum cartridge. Usually I just wear a Trooper MK3, but I had a chance to pick up the Python, and I couldn't pass it up. $400.
"You've been married twice? I don't see how you could bring yourself to do that. I mean, Jesus, I thought marriage was a real commitment. Like souls, you know, fused all through eternity and shit like that."
$400 is a steal. How'd you pull that off?"
I squinted at him.
"What is it? Are you Catholic or something?"
"No, just dumb, I guess. I got my notions of romance out of ladies' magazines in the beauty shop my mother ran when I was growing up. The gun I got from Dave Whitaker's estate. His widow hates guns and never liked it that he got into 'em, so she unloaded his collection first chance she got.
I'd have paid the going rate, but she wouldn't hear of it. Do you know her? Bess Whitaker?
I shook my head. He glanced up then as Rosie put a plate down in front of each of us. I could tell by his look that he hadn't expected green peppers with a vinaigrette, even with little curlicues of parsley tucked here and there. Usually Rosie waited until I tasted a dish and gave elaborate restaurant reviewer-type raves, but this time she seemed to think better of it. As soon as she left, Jonah leaned forward.
What is this shit?
Just eat.
Kinsey, for the last 10 years I've been eating with kids who sit and pick all the onions and mushrooms out. I don't know how to eat if it's not made with hamburger helper.
You're in for a big surprise, I said. What have you been eating for the year since your wife left?
She put all these dinners in the deep freeze. Every night I thaw one and stick it in the oven at 350 for an hour. I guess she went to a garage sale and bought up a bunch of those TV dinner tins with the little compartments. She wanted me to eat well-balanced meals, even though she was fucking me over financially.
I lowered my fork and looked at him, trying to picture someone freezing up 365 dinners so she could bug out.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
I lowered my fork and looked at him, trying to picture someone freezing up 365 dinners so she could bug out. This was the woman he apparently imagined mating with for life, like owls. He was eating his first bite of pepper salad, his eyes turning inward. His facial expression suggested that the pepper was sitting in the middle of his tongue while he made chewing motions around it. I do that myself with those mashed, candied sweet potatoes people insist on at Thanksgiving time. Why would anyone put a marshmallow on a vegetable? Would I put licorice on asparagus or jelly beans on Brussels sprouts? The very idea makes my mouth purse. Jonah nodded philosophically to himself and began to fork up the pepper salad with gusto. It must have been at least as tasty as the shit Camilla cooked for him. I pictured tray after tray of frozen tuna casserole with crushed potato chips, with maybe frozen peas in one compartment, carrot coins in the next. I bet she left him 6 packs of canned fruit cocktail for dessert. He was looking at me. He said,
"What's the matter? Why do you have that look on your face?"
I shrugged. "Marriage is a mystery."
"I'll second that," he said. "By the way, how's your case shaping up?"
"Well, I'm still nosing around," I said. "Right now I'm making a little side investigation into an unsolved murder. Her next-door neighbor was killed the same week she left."
"That doesn't sound good. What's the connection?"
"I don't know yet. Maybe none. It just struck me as an interesting sequence of events that Marty Grice was murdered and Elaine Bolt disappeared within days of it."
"Was there a positive ID?"
"On Marty? I have no idea. Dolan's getting really anal retentive about that stuff. He won't tell me a thing."
"Why not take a look at the files?"
"Oh, come on. He's not going to let me see the files."
"So don't ask him. Ask me. I can make copies if you tell me what you want."
"Jonah, he would fire your ass. You would never work again. You'd have to sell shoes for the rest of your life."
"Why would he have to know?"
"How could you get away with it? He knows everything."
"Bullshit. The files are kept over in identification and records. I'll bet he's got a second set in his office, so he probably never even looks at the originals. I'll just wait till he's out and Xerox whatever you need. Then I'll put it back."
"Don't you have to sign him out?" He gave me a look then like I was probably the kind of person who never parked in a red zone. Actually, for someone to whom lying comes so easily, I get anxious about vehicle codes and overdue library books. Violations of the public trust. Oh, hey, once in a while I might pick a lock illegally, but not if I think there's a chance I'll get caught. The idea of sneaking official documents out of the police station made my stomach squeeze down like I was on the verge of getting a tetanus shot. "Oh, well, don't do that," I said. "You can't."
"What do you mean I can't? Of course I can. What do you want to see? Autopsy? Incident report? Follow-up interviews? Lab reports?"
"That'd be great. That would really help." I looked up guiltily. Rosie was standing there waiting to pick up our salad plates. I leaned back in the booth and waited until both had been removed. "Look, I'd never ask you to do such a thing."
"You didn't ask. I volunteered. Quit being such a candy ass. You can turn around and do me a favor sometime."
"But Jonah, he really is a nut about department leaks. You know how he gets. Please don't put yourself in jeopardy."
"Don't sweat it. Homicide detectives are full of crap sometimes. You're not going to blow his case for him. He probably doesn't even have a case, so what's to worry about?"
After dinner, he walked me back over to my place. It was only 8:15, but I had work to do, and he really seemed a bit relieved that the contact between us wasn't going to be prolonged or intimate. As soon as I heard his footsteps retreat, I turned the outside lights off, sat down at my desk with some index cards, and caught up with my notes. I checked back through the cards I'd filled out before and tacked them up on the big bulletin board above my desk. I stood there for a long time, reading card after card, hoping for a flash of enlightenment. Only one curious note emerged. I'd been very meticulous about writing down every single item I remembered from my first search of Elaine's apartment. I do that routinely, almost like a little game I play with myself to test my memory. In the kitchen cabinet, she'd had some cans of cat food. 9 Lives beef and liver platter, said the note. Now it seemed out of place to me. What cat? Chapter 12. At 9 the next morning, I drove over to Via Madrina. Tilly didn't answer my buzz, so I stood for a minute surveying the list of tenants' names on the directory. There was a W.M. period Hoover in apartment 10, right next door to Elaine's. I gave him a buzz. The intercom came to life.
"Yes?"
"Mr. Hoover, this is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private detective here in town, and I'm looking for Elaine Bolt. Would you mind if I asked you a couple of questions?"
"You mean right this minute?"
"Well, yes, if you wouldn't mind. I stopped by to talk to the building manager, but she's not here." I could hear a murmur of conversation, and then the door buzzed at me by way of consent. I had to jump to catch it while the lock would still open. I took the elevator up a floor. Apartment 10 was just across from me when the elevator door slid open. Hoover was standing in the hall in a short blue terry cloth robe with snags. I estimated his age at 34, 35. He was slight, maybe 5'6", with slim, muscular legs faintly matted with down. His dark hair was tousled, and he looked as if he hadn't shaved for 2 days. His eyes were still baggy from sleep.
"Oh, God, I woke you up," I said. "I hate to do that to people."
"No, I've been up," he said.
He ran a hand across his hair, scratching the back of his head while he yawned. I had to clamp my teeth so I wouldn't yawn in response. Barefoot, he moved back into the apartment, and I followed him.
"I just put some coffee on. It'll be ready in a sec. Come on in and have a seat."
His voice was light and reedy. He indicated the kitchen to the right. His apartment was the flip image of Elaine's, and my guess was that their two master bedrooms shared a wall. I glanced at the living room, which, like hers, opened off the entryway, and also looked down on the Grice's property next door. Where Elaine's apartment had a view of the street, this one didn't have much to recommend it. Only a glimpse of the mountains off to the left, partially obscured by the 2 rows of Italian stone pines that grow along Via Madrina. Hoover adjusted his short robe and sat down on a kitchen chair, crossing his legs. His knees were cute.
"What's your name again?"
"I'm sorry, I'm still half unconscious."
"Kinsey Milhone," I said.
The kitchen smelled of brewing coffee and the fumes of unbrushed teeth. His, not mine. He reached for a slim brown cigarette and lit it, hoping perhaps to mask his morning mouth with something worse. His eyes were a mild tobacco brown, his lashes sparse, face lean. He regarded me with all the boredom of a boa constrictor after a heavy meal of groundhog. The percolator gave a few last burps and subsided while he reached for 2 big blue and white mugs. One had an overall design of bunny rabbits humping. The other portrayed elephants similarly occupied. I tried not to look.
The thing I've worried about for years is how dinosaurs mated, especially those great big spiny ones. Someone told me once they did it in water, which helped support all that weight, but I find it hard to believe dinosaurs were that smart. It didn't seem likely with those tiny pinched heads. I shook myself back to reality. What do you call yourself? William? Bill? Wim, he said. He fetched a carton of milk from the refrigerator and found a spoon for the sugar bowl. I added milk to my coffee and watched with interest while he added 2 heaping tablespoons of sugar to his. He caught my look. I'm trying to gain a little weight, he said. I know the sugar's bad for my teeth, but I've been doing up these torturous protein drinks in the morning. You know, the kind with egg and banana and wheat germ thrown in. Ugh. The aftertaste just cannot be disguised. Besides, I hate to eat before 2 in the afternoon, so I guess I should resign myself to being thin. Anyway, that's why I load up my coffee. I figure anything's bound to help. You look a little on the twiggy side yourself. I run every day, and I forget to eat. I sipped my coffee, which was scented faintly with mint. It was really very good. How well did you know Elaine? I asked. We spoke when we ran into one another in the hall, he said. We've been neighbors for years. Why do you want her? Did she run out on her bills? I told him briefly about her apparent absence, adding that the explanation didn't have to be sinister, but that it was puzzling nevertheless. Do you remember when you saw her last? Not really. Sometime before she went off. Christmas, I guess. No, I take that back. I did see her New Year's Eve. She said she was staying home. Do you happen to know if she had a cat? Oh, sure, gorgeous thing. A massive gray Persian named Mingus. He was actually my cat originally, but I was hardly ever home, and I thought he should have company, so I gave him to her. He was just a kitten at the time. I had no idea he'd turn out to be such a beauty, or I never would have given him up. I mean, I've kicked myself ever since, but what can one do? A deal's a deal. What was the deal? He shrugged indifferently. I made her swear she'd never change his name, Charlie Mingus, after the jazz pianist. Also, she had to promise not to leave him by himself, or what was the point in giving him away? I might as well have kept him myself. Wim took a careful drag of his cigarette, resting his elbow on the kitchen table. I could hear the shower running somewhere in the back of the apartment. Did she take him with her to Florida every year? Oh, sure. Sometimes right up in the cabin if the airline had the space. She said he loved it down there, thought he owned the place. He picked up a napkin and folded it in half. Well, it's curious he hasn't shown up someplace. He's probably still with her, wherever she is. Did you talk to her after that murder next door? Wim shook his head, neatly flicking ash into the folded napkin. I did talk to the police, or rather they talked to me. My living room windows look right down on that house, and they were interested in what I could have seen. Which was nothing, I might add. That detective was the biggest macho asshole I've ever met, and I didn't appreciate his antagonistic attitude. Can I warm that up for you? He got up and fetched the coffee. I nodded, and he topped off both our mugs, pouring from a thermos. The sound of running water had abruptly ceased, and Wim took note of it just as I did. He went back to the sink and extinguished his cigarette by running it under the tap, and then he tossed it in the trash. He got out a frying pan and took a package of bacon from the refrigerator. I'd offer you breakfast, but I don't have enough unless you want to join me in a protein drink. I'm going to make that up in a minute, disgusting as it is. I'm doing real food for a friend of mine. I've got to go shortly anyway, I said, getting up. He waved at me impatiently. Sit down, sit down. Finish your coffee, at any rate. You might as well ask whatever you want as long as you're here. What about a vet for the cat? Did she have someone in the neighborhood? Wim peeled off 3 strips of bacon and laid them in the pan, flipping on the gas. He leaned over, peering at the low blue flame. He had to tug his robe down in back. He said, There's a cat clinic around the corner on Serenata Street. She used to take Ming over in one of those cat carriers, howling like a coyote. He hated the vet. You have any guesses about where Elaine might be?
What about her sister? Maybe she's gone down to L.A. to see her.
The sister was the one who hired me in the first place, I said. She hasn't seen Elaine in years.
Wim looked up sharply from the bacon pan and laughed.
What a crock of shit! Who told you that? I met her up here myself not 6 months back.
You met Beverly?
Sure, he said. He took a fork and pushed the bacon strips in the pan. He went back to the refrigerator and got out 3 eggs. I was starving to death just watching this stuff. He continued chattily. She was maybe 4 years younger than Elaine. Black hair, cut gamin style, exquisite skin. He looked at me. Am I right or am I not?
Sounds like the woman I met, I said. But I wonder why she lied to me.
I can probably guess, he said.
He tore off some paper toweling and folded it, putting it near the frying pan.
They had that nasty falling out, you know, at Christmas time.
Beverly probably doesn't want the word to get out.
They positively shrieked and threw things, door slamming. Oh, my God! And the language they used? It was obscene. I had no idea Elaine could swear like that, though I must say the other one was worse.
What was it about?
A man, of course. What else do any of us fuss about?
You have any idea who it was?
Nope. Frankly, I suspect Elaine's one of those women who's secretly thrilled with widowhood. She gets a lot of sympathy, tons of freedom. She has all that money and no one to hassle with. Why cut some guy in on a deal like that? She's better off by herself.
Why quarrel with Beverly if that's the case?
Who knows? Maybe they thought it was fun.
I finished my coffee and got up then.
I better scoot. I don't want to interrupt your breakfast, but I may want to get back to you. Are you listed in the book?
Of course.
I do work. Tending bar at the Edgewood Hotel near the beach. You know the place?
I can't afford it, but I know which one you mean.
Pop in and visit sometime. I'm there from 6 until closing, every night except Monday. I'll buy you a drink.
Thanks, Wim. I'll do that. I appreciate your help. The coffee was a treat.
Anytime, he said.
I let myself out, catching a glimpse of Wim's breakfast mate, who looked like something out of Gentleman's Quarterly. Sultry eyes, a perfect jawline, collarless shirt, and an Italian cashmere sweater tossed across his shoulders with the sleeves folded into a knot in front. In the kitchen, Wim had started to sing a version of The Man I Love. His singing voice sounded just like Marlene Dietrich's. When I reached the lobby, I ran into Tilly, who was pushing a wire cart in front of her like a stroller. It was loaded with brown paper bags.
"I feel like I go to the market twice a day," she said. "Are you here looking for me?"
"Yes, but when you weren't in, I went up and had a brief chat with Wim instead. I didn't realize Elaine Bolt had a cat."
"Oh, she's had Ming for years. I don't know why I didn't think to mention that. I wonder what she did with him."
"You said she had some carry-on luggage that night going out to the cab. Could it have been Mingus in the cat carrier?"
"Well, it must have been. It was certainly big enough, and she did take the cat with her everywhere she went. I guess he's missing, too. Isn't that what you're getting at?"
"I don't know yet, but probably. Too bad he's not suffering from some rare cat disease, so I could track him down through a veterinarian someplace," I said.
She shook her head. "Can't help you there. He's in good health as far as I ever knew.
He'd be easy to recognize. Big old gray long-haired thing. He must have weighed almost 20 pounds.
"Was he purebred?"
"No, and she'd had him neutered early on, so he wasn't used for breeding purposes or anything like that."
"Well," I said, "I may as well start checking up on him, too, since I don't have anything else at this point."
"Did you talk to the police yesterday?"
"Oh, yes, and told them we thought the woman might have stolen Elaine's bills when she broke in. The officer looked at me like he thought I was nuts, but he did write it down."
"I'll tell you something else Wim brought up. He swears Elaine's sister Beverly was up here at Christmas time and got into a big fight with her. Were you aware of that?"
"No, I wasn't. And Elaine never mentioned anything about it either," she said, shifting restlessly. "I've got to go in, Kinsey. I've got some sherbet that'll leak right out if I don't pop it in the freezer soon."
"All right. I'll get back to you later if I need anything else," I said. "Thanks, Tilly."
Tilly went on through the lobby, lugging her grocery cart,
and I went back to my car and unlocked it. I glanced over at the Grice's house as usual, my attention drawn almost irresistibly to that half-charred ruin where the murder had taken place. On impulse, I locked my car again and trotted up to the Snyder's front door. He must have spotted me through the window because the door opened just as I raised my hand to knock. He stepped out on the porch.
"I saw you coming up the walk. You're the one who was here yesterday," he said. "I don't remember your name."
"Kinsey Milhone. I talked to Mr. Grice out at his sister's house yesterday. He said you had a key to his place and would let me in so I could take a look around."
"Yes, that's right. I got it here somewhere."
Mr. Snyder seemed to frisk himself and then fished a key ring out of his pocket. He sorted through the keys.
"This is it," he said.
He wrestled the key off the ring and handed it to me.
"That's the back door. Front's all boarded up, as you can see. For a time there, they had the whole place cordoned off till them fellas from the crime scene unit could go over everything."
From the rear, I heard,
"What is it, Oris? Who's that you're talking to?"
"Hold your horses, you old coot. I gotta go,"
he said, his jowls a-tremble. "I'll bring this back when I'm done," I said, but he was already lumbering off toward the back of the house in a snit. I thought she could hear remarkably well for someone he claimed was as deaf as a loaf of bread. I cut across the Snyder's yard, the ivy rustling under my feet. The Grice's front lawn was dead from neglect, and the sidewalk was littered with debris. It didn't look as if it had been cleaned up since the fire trucks departed, and I was crossing my fingers that the salvage crew had never gone in to clear the place out. I went around the side, passing the padlocked double doors that were slanted up against the house and led down into the basement. At the rear of the house, I climbed 5 crumbling steps onto a small back porch. The back door had a big glass window in the upper half, and I could see into the kitchen through ruffled curtains that were dingy now and hung crookedly. I unlocked the door and let myself in. For once, I was in luck. The floor was covered with rubble, but the furniture was still in place. Kitchen table filthy, chairs knocked askew. I left the door open behind me and surveyed the room. There were dishes on the counter, shelves of canned goods visible through an open pantry door. I was feeling a faint thrill of uneasiness, as I always do in situations like these. The house smelled richly of scorched wood, and there was a heavy layer of soot on everything. The kitchen walls were gray with smoke, and my shoes made a gritty sound as I moved through to the hallway, crushing broken glass to a sugary consistency underfoot. As nearly as I could tell, the interior of the Grice's house was laid out like the Snyder's house next door, and I could identify what I guessed was the dining room just off the kitchen, with a blackened swinging door between. This must be the counterpart to the room in the Snyder's house that Oris had now outfitted as a bedroom for his wife. There was a half-bath across the hall, just the toilet and sink. The old linoleum had blistered and buckled, showing blackened floorboards beneath. The window in the hallway was broken now, but it looked out onto a narrow walkway between the two houses, and right into May Snyder's converted bedroom. I could see her clearly, lying on a hospital bed that had been cranked up to a 45-degree angle. She seemed to be asleep, looking small and shrunken under a white counterpane. I moved away from the window and down the hall toward the living room. The fire had leached the color out of everything, and it looked now like a black-and-white photograph. The char patterns, like dark stretches of alligator hide, covered door frames and window sashes. The destruction became more pronounced as I moved toward the front of the house. As I passed the stairs leading to the half-story up above, I could see where the flames had chewed the treads and part of the wooden banister. The wallpaper in the stairwell was as tattered and inky as an old treasure map. I moved on, trying to get my bearings. There was an ominous patch of missing floorboards near the front door, where I imagined Marty Grice's body had been found. Flames had eaten up the walls, leaving pipes and blackened beams exposed. Across the floor, here, and extending back down the hall and up the stairs, there were irregular burned trails where an accelerant of some kind had been splashed. I bypassed the gaping hole in the floor and peered into the living room, which looked as if it had been outfitted with avant-garde works of furniture, made entirely of charcoal briquettes. Two chairs and a couch were still arranged in a conversational grouping, but the fire had gnawed the upholstery right down to the bare springs. All that remained of the coffee table was a burned frame. I went back to the stairs and crept up with care. The fire had taken the bedroom in whimsical bites, leaving a stack of paperback books untouched, while the footstool nearby had been almost completely consumed. The bed was still made, but the room had been drenched by the fire hoses and smelled now of rotting carpet fiber and soggy wallpaper. Mildewed blankets, singed clothing, and clumps of insulation that had boiled out through the fire-bared lath and plaster here and there. On the bed-table, there was a framed photograph of Leonard with an appointment card for a teeth cleaning and exam tucked in the edge of the glass. I moved the card aside, peering closely at Leonard's face. I thought about the snapshot I'd seen of Marty. Such a dumpy little thing. Overweight, plastic eyeglass frames, a hairdo that looked like a wig. Leonard was much more attractive, and in happier times presented a trim appearance, a rather distinguished face, graying hair, a steady gaze. His shoulders were rounded, possibly because of his back problems, but it gave the impression of something weak or apologetic in his nature. I wondered if Elaine Bolt had found him appealing. Could she have come between these two? I put the picture back and picked my way down the stairs. As I moved along the wall toward the kitchen, I noticed a door ajar, and I pushed it open gingerly. Before me yawned the basement, looking like a vast black pit. Shit! In the interest of being thorough, I knew I'd have to check it out. I made a face to myself and went out to my car to get the flashlight out of the glove compartment. Chapter 13. The basement stairs were intact. The fire had apparently been contained before it reached this far. The damage to the rooms above seemed to be the result of some accelerant that had ensured at least a superficial combustion throughout the house. The beam from my flashlight cut through the dark, illuminating a narrow, moving path filled with things I didn't want to touch. I reached the bottom of the stairs. There wasn't a lot of headroom. The house was more than 40 years old, and the foundation was dank and spider-pocked. The air felt dense, like the atmosphere in a greenhouse, except that everything down here was dead, exuding that fenny perfume of old fire and old damp, abandonment and rot. I angled the light along the joists, tracing the beams to the hole where daylight spilled down. Had the floor burned through and the body tumbled into the basement? I moved closer, craning to see better. The edges of the hole looked cut to me. Maybe the fire inspector had taken samples of the boards for lab tests. To my left, I could see the furnace, a silent, squat bulge of gray, with sooty ducting extending in all directions. The floor was hard-packed dirt and cracked concrete, the entire space filled with junk. Paint cans and old window screens were stacked up under the stairs, and there was an ancient galvanized sink in the corner, the pipes corroded away. I toured the perimeter, poking the light into spaces where eight-legged creatures skittered away from me, horrified. Later I was glad I'd been such a conscientious little bun, but at the time I only wanted to get out of there as quickly as I could. An empty house always seems to make those noises that have you wondering if an axe murderer is creeping through the premises in search of prey. I shone the flashlight over to the far wall, where the stairs jutted up a short distance to the bolted double doors leading out to the side yard. Daylight slanted through the cracks, but the smell of fresh air didn't sift down this far. I knew the double doors were padlocked on the outside, but the wood was old and crumbly and didn't seem that secure. From what Lily Howe had said, the burglar hadn't even bothered with breaking and entering. He'd marched right up to the front door and rung the bell. Had they struggled? Had he panicked when she opened the door and killed her instantly? The intruder might have been a woman, of course, especially if the weapon had actually been a baseball bat.
Ever since Title IX, women have become more adept at the sportier sidearms. Death by discus, javelin, shot put, bow and arrow, hockey puck. The possibilities are endless, one would think. I moved back toward the stairs, shivering involuntarily with the darkness at my back. I took the steps two at a time, nearly knocking myself out when I banged into a crossbeam. I cursed soundly to myself, bursting out of the basement and into the hall again as though pursued. Something feathery caught my eye, and when I realized it was a delicate centipede whiffling down my front, I did this erratic, quick dance step, brushing my shirt like I'd suddenly burst into flames. God, the things I do for money, I thought savagely. I went out the back door, locking it behind me, and sat down on the porch steps. My breathing finally slowed, but it took me a few more minutes to regain my composure. In the meantime, I had a chance to check the backyard. I don't know what I was looking for, or what I thought I might find after 6 months. There were only overgrown bushes and weeds, a little orange tree crippled by the lack of water, and covered with hard fruit turning brown because it hadn't been picked. The shed was one of those prefabricated metal jobs you can order through the Sears catalog and put up anywhere. It was secured by a nice, big, fat padlock that looked sturdy enough. I crossed the yard and inspected it. It was actually a simple warded lock I thought I could open in a few minutes, but I didn't have my little double-headed pick key with me. And I wasn't crazy about the idea of standing out there fiddling with a padlock in broad daylight. Better I should come back when the sun went down and find out what Grice or his nephew kept in there. Old lawn furniture was my guess, but one can never be sure. I took the house key back to Mr. Snyder and then got in my car and headed over to the office. I let myself in and made a pot of coffee. The mail wasn't in yet, and there were no messages on my machine. I opened the French doors and stood out on the balcony. Where the fuck was Elaine Bolt? And where was Elaine Bolt's pussycat? I was running out of things to do and places to look. I typed up a contract for Julia Oxner to sign and stuck that in my outbox. When the coffee was ready, I poured myself some and sat down in my swivel chair and swiveled. When in doubt, I thought, it's best to fall back on routine. I made a long-distance telephone call to a newspaper in Boca Raton and another call to a paper in Sarasota, placing classified ads in the personals columns of each. Anybody knowing the whereabouts of Elaine Bolt, female, Caucasian, age 43, etc., please contact, with my name, address, and phone number, and an invitation to call collect.